tell me welcome our speaker tonight, Karen from the Primary Purpose Group in Trucksville, PA.
Thank you. I was watching Liz. I was going to see what she did about this whole thing. I was just going to talk into, let it be up my forehead. I don't know. Hi, everybody. I'm Karen, and I am a recovered alcoholic. Hi. Thank you so much for having me down here. It's beautiful here. I came down the turnpike, and this is easy, and that's good because I get lost real easy, even with my GPS. I just can't seem to stay on the purple road ever. So this was really good, but I did. You guys have Dunkin' Donuts. And you have a Wawa. Like, I would never leave this town. It's really beautiful now. But as I'm driving up here, I'm like, well, I'm an alcoholic. Where the hell do they get their alcohol? A lot of corn. I guess you got to make your own. I don't know. I'm trying to plan. I don't know. Guys, I do have a recovery date, and I don't know what it is. Because according to her book, time just doesn't matter. And you know what, there's just way too much good stuff going on to waste your time counting. I don't know, going back, I mean, and this always scares people, and I know that, you know, I can remember back at 5 years old, okay, so don't panic, because I know you're sitting there going, oh my God, she's 100. It's going to be a very long meeting. don't worry, I won't do that to you. But I can remember, like, my illness of alcoholism just always being there. Always being there. Fear. You know, I went to kindergarten when I was 4. That's a horrible thing to do to a child. You know? And my bus number is 5. Do you know how I know my bus number is 5? Because I was so freaking scared that I was going to get on the wrong bus and end up in Texas or somewhere, even though school was only a mile from my house. So, like, fear, always there, fear. But I can also remember then, I found the nurse, by the way. I was a very sickly child. She let you go home, you know, because school is just scary. Then I can remember getting into that big, oh my God, my parents had that station wagon, you know, with the wood grain down the side, you know. And we get in that back seat and we're going on vacation, and I don't know. Some of you people are older, you might remember this. You young people probably don't know anything about this, but they used to have this medicine, and it was called Paragoric. Oh, yeah. Well, you got that from the doctor for your child. You used to rub it on their gums. You used to give a little squirt in the mouth if they were acting up a little bit, you know, settle you right down. My mom would give me this Paragoric. It was in an eyedropper. Man, that stuff tastes like shit. But I got to tell you, 5 years old, I'm sitting in the back of that station wagon. And I got the eyedropper, and it was well worth it. And pretty soon, I'm going, oh, yeah, the trip is beginning. Now, I did not become a daily Paragoric user. I got to tell you that. All right, but I can tell you this. The next year when we went on vacation, I said to my mom, hey, don't forget my medicine. She thought it was so cute. Thought it was so good. The trip is beginning. But, yeah, so, I don't know, I started drinking early. I'm pretty much kind of like Bill W., you know. I'm straight-up alcoholic, except in the morning I had to quiet the nerves with sedatives, you know, like Xanax. I used to take them because they were kind of like a, I don't know, Xanax vitamin to me. Like, it stopped the shaking and stuff, and it got me through my day until I could get back to the booze again. So that was kind of my deal, but I started drinking real early, and, you know, it was my parents' fault. They had, oh, your parents must have been at fault too. Anyway, they had a bar in the basement, and, you know, I don't know, any 12-year-old would partake, my mind. Like, I don't know. My friends didn't. I really didn't notice that too much, but they would have. They just weren't as smart as me, you know. So I get Dad the beer after work, you know. Dad, I'll go get your beer. And, yeah, you got to chug real fast, though, because they time it, kind of, you know. They probably don't, but I thought they did, so, yeah. So I'd chug that beer and then up with his beer, and I'd watch, man. I'd wait. Dad, you need another one? Yeah. So I enjoyed it. I'm sure we all did, to some degree. in the beginning. I thought it was marvelous, actually. So when I got into high school, you know, I quickly found seniors because they have booths, and that was great. I started a job when I was 13 years old in the hospital kitchen, and I lied about my age to get the job. I met my husband there. I'm still married to him. I don't know why. But, yeah. I didn't date him at 13 years old because that was kind of gross because he was 4 years older than me, so 17 and, you know, 13 wasn't so great. But when I turned 17 and I asked him out for a date, well, you could do the math, right? Yeah, 4 years older than me, he could do things for me that I couldn't do for myself. He was able to go in the liquor store. It was great. I love him. So, yeah, so I got married to him. And at age 20, crazy. We ended up moving up to New York for a little bit, and then from New York we moved on down to Florida, and like we partied all the time, and it was great. There's this guy in the book, and they don't really give this guy a name. I think he's on page 32. You know, our illness, it's progressive, and that's the one thing that you just can't determine is the progression. That's why I guess you sit next to somebody who's, you know, 55 and really just started having a problem with this stuff for the last 10 years. But then you sit next to somebody who's 20, already brought to their knees. I don't know. Like that guy in the book on page 32, my illness of alcoholism had not progressed past the point where I needed the aid of spirituality in order to stop drinking. That guy, they said he had a good enough reason to stop. His reason, well, there's a big book group, you know his reason. And at age 27, my husband and I are living in Florida, and I have a good enough reason to stop drinking. And the reason was we wanted to start to have a family. And quite honestly, guys, I drank very alcoholically. I didn't know I was an alcoholic, but I was the party girl, you know? And I never, ever wanted my girls. I didn't know I was having girls at that point, though. But I didn't want my children to ever see alcohol because I told you it was my parents' fault, you know, making it so accessible for me. So I put Dick Thug in the jug. Well, let me tell you something. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I'm not an alcoholic if you don't drink, right? Well, here it comes, guys, because you see, we suffer from this thing that is like a soul sickness. I have this big gaping hole. It's a God-sized hole, and I am filling it with something. Because you see, I do have these abilities that I was born with. I wonder where I got these. I have the ability to love. I have the ability to forgive. I have the ability to worship. And I have the ability to have faith in something. And I'm going to use all those abilities that I have, and I'm going to fill that hole. And I did. And I filled that God-sized hole with my kids, and I have two girls. Now, here comes the raw, uncut version of untreated alcoholism. So if anybody is just thinking maybe they should just put the plug in the junk and not pick up God or the steps, the big book, you know, I wouldn't suggest it. I became mother extraordinaire. You see, my kids were everything to me. You couldn't have told me that that was wrong. That's exactly what I was supposed to be doing. You know, I have this husband, I told you I still have him, and he never gave me good reason for this, but guys, when I brought that baby home from the hospital, I kind of looked at him and said, I don't know, man, like, I don't think I'm going to let you take care of him. Like, you might kill her or something. And, like, you don't pay enough attention to details, like, no offense, okay, but, because, see, I'm good. I'm just good like this. As a matter of fact, I won't let anybody watch my child. Well, My husband's an electrical engineer and I'm a math teacher. So having said that, I'm going to tell you that, yeah, there is not much romance in our house. There's a lot of logic. There's a lot of calculating. And so we calculated and we had this child on the last day of school. Okay, because here was the plan. Anybody have good plans? I got great plans. Till I don't. And so I have this plan that I'm going to have this child at the last day of school, and then I'll take those 3 months off, and then I'll go back to school. And I felt like that was probably a really good plan because I've never had a child before, but I am a dog owner, and I'm pretty good at that. So anyways, I have this child. Well, children are different than dogs, and I bring this child home, and now this child is everything, still in this God hole, right? Nothing's going to happen this good. So the end of summer starts to roll around, and guys, do you ever hear that the root of our trouble was selfishness and self-centeredness? But we don't think so. Yeah. Anyway, so the end of summer starts rolling around. My husband says to me, well, are you looking at daycares? And I said, yeah, as a matter of fact, I did. He goes, and? I said, well, I went in, okay, in this one daycare, and there were all these baby swings lined up, and there were like swinging babies, crying. It was like a mini concentration camp. Our daughter's not going there. He said, well, and? I said, oh, and I resigned. I'm staying home. I'm a stay-at-home mom. He said, what are we going to do? I said, well, I just told you, I'm a stay-at-home mom. What are you going to do? I don't know. Second job? I don't know. Not my problem. I've got my responsibility right here. God love the man. This is why I'm telling you. I don't know why he's still with me. Anyway, I tortured him. Okay, I tortured this man. He's clinically insane as a result of me, and I do have a living amends that I have to take care of him. But, So I stay home with the child. We have this other child. I'm an equally good mother with that one. Mm-hmm. No one can watch these children. Okay, with the exception of one person, my mother. My mother is like my best friend. You know, talked to her every day, told her everything. You have those people in your life? You know, those ones that, oh, it's okay, honey. No, no, you're right. Those kind, I love those people. That was my mom. And she could do no wrong, as far as I was concerned. She's a wonderful woman. My dad was pretty good, too. But my mom, special. So anyway, we're living in Florida, and we have these two children, and I'm originally from up here. By the way, did you know that when you move to Florida and you come all the way back home, you're a fullback? I'm a fullback, okay? I was there for 23 years, and I came fully back. If you only go back to North Carolina, you're a halfback. And then if you only move back to Georgia, you're a quarterback. So that's just for future information if you ever move to Florida. So anyway, my kids are now 3 years old and 1 year old, stay-at-home mom. And I decided that they should see snow. And so we came up to visit Grandma and Grandpa, who they call Mimi and Bobby, for the month of February. And we were staying with my mom and dad, and they got to see snow. And it was the end of February, and we were packing up to go back home. And my mom said to me, you know, my back is really hurting me right now. She said, I think I need to go and lay down on the bed. And I said, all right, Mom, well, you've been carrying the baby around, you know, and you're not used to it. You probably pulled something. She said, yeah, I feel like I'm going to throw up. She went in to lay down on the bed, and my dad went in about 30 minutes later to check on my mom. And she was dead. She had suffered a massive heart attack. And he called me into the room. And guys, I got to tell you, when I stood in that doorway and I looked, my mom, her face was blue. I can't tell you the feeling. Like, it was just like there was something removed from inside of me. Like, it was bad. I went into the room. I checked for a pulse, checked for breathing, and there was none. My dad and I got her down onto the floor. My first job, I used to be a nurse. I hated that. It's a different story. So we got her down on the floor, and I started CPR on my mom. Now, back in the day, they taught you to do CPR like this. 1-1,000, 2-1,000. And I can remember this, doing the compressions on my mom and saying, 1-1,000, and I'm crying. And I'm looking up and I'm saying, God, I'm not ready for this 1,000. 1,000. Please, God, don't take her from me, 1,000. Did I mention the root of our problem? Selfishness and self-centeredness? Who am I praying for? My mom's dead. I'm praying for me. How's this going to affect me? No one could have told me that either at the time. Anyway, the ambulance came and they took my mom out, and she did have a heartbeat when she left the house. She wasn't breathing though, so they put her in the hospital on a ventilator, and the girls and I stayed on up here with my dad, and we would go to see her every day. And about maybe 4 days in, she began to assist the ventilator, and she began to breathe on her own, and they removed the ventilator. And I had 5 separate doctors come to me, but guys, I'm an untreated alcoholic, okay? I get annoyed. I had 5 separate doctors that came to me, and they said, what happened? Like, explain how this happened. I'm annoyed. 5 different people. What the hell? Don't they believe me? I told them exactly what I just told you. And they said to me, this doesn't happen. I said, what doesn't happen? That you find someone after 30 minutes and that they come back. And I said, well, what I'm seeing in that bed, if you're calling that life, that's what she came back to. She's unconscious. The doctors told me that she was brain dead because the lack of oxygen, or at least severely brain damaged, but they wouldn't know that for a few days. So about a week and a half in, the blood stopped going to my mom's feet. And they turned gray, and the doctor called me and said, the circulation, it won't get to the feet. The vessels won't support it, so we're going to have to do amputations. But we can't do those right now because of the recent heart attack. If we had given her anesthesia right now, she would die. So what we have to do is we have to wait and let gangrene set in to the legs. And when the infection runs through her bloodstream, we'll do emergency amputations. I said, okay. Things aren't looking real good. I'm watching my mom as they roll her and, you know, try to care for her, and she's screaming in pain. The legs are turning black. They're dying. My dad, though, when we would come home at night, I go to sleep. Has it ever happened to you where you go to sleep and somebody's in the room and they wake you up just by sensing they're there? That's a little weird, isn't it? And I'd sense something and I'd wake up and I'd say, Dad, what's the matter? And he'd say to me, there's Indians in the backyard. And I'd say, no, Dad, there's no Indians. You're dreaming. Go back to bed. Which started to begin driving to the same hospital. My dad would say to me, who are we going to see? And I said, we're going to see Mom. And he said, oh, my mom. I said, no, Dad, my mom. Your mom's been dead for years. So I took him to the doctor, and he had Alzheimer's. So things aren't going so well. The day came when the infection went through my mom's body, and they called me, and so we have to do the emergency amputations now because her fever's up to 104. And they did, it with a local anesthetic. God, just like on the battlefield. My mom was in the hospital for a total of 3.5 months, and at that point, it was about 3 months. And so in the next 2-week period of time, my mom would come too on occasion. She didn't know who anyone was or where she was or who she was, or you couldn't really even speak to her. And they told me that was the brain damage. But she could scoot around the bed a little bit, and she was getting those stumps into her own feces because she was incontinent of her bowels. And so both incisions were now infected and pussing, and it was bad. The doctor said to me at the end of the 3.5 months, he said, well, this is all we could do for your mom. So what we're going to do is we're going to put a feeding tube in and we're going to send her to the nursing home. And I said, no, that's okay. I don't want a feeding tube. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, I'll feed her. You're going to feed her. Yeah. And I said, and I don't want her to go to a nursing home. I said, I'll take her home. And he looked at me and goes, I don't know if anyone's ever done this to you. And he looked at me and these were his words. Are you crazy? And this is what I did. Because all my life, people have said things to me such as, what's wrong with you? Indicating there must be something wrong with me. I don't think there's anything wrong with me. It's just who I am. It's me. So I said to him, well, some people have said that. I said, and I don't mean any disrespect by this, but my mom now has bed sores. Both incisions are infected. She has a urinary tract infection because of the catheter. She's begun with a seizure disorder. It's not looking real promising, but I don't see how I could do a worse job at home. And I said to him, what's your biggest fear, that she's going to die? So she dies at home. Is there something wrong with that? And he let me take her home. And I was scared out of my mind. I got home. I'm standing in the doorway. The ambulance came and brought my mom. We had a hospital bed. It was all set up out there. And I'm standing in the doorway. And my three-year-old is up on the bed. She ran in and got on the bed with my mom. And as I'm standing in the doorway, I listen. I hear my mom say, Katie. That's my daughter's name. She said, what happened to me? And my three-year-old said to her, Mimi, you were dead. My mom said to her, what happened to my legs? Was I in a car accident? At that point, I looked up, and I'm going to be completely honest with you. I don't know what this God is, but this God has power, man. Power to do anything. And at that point in time, I looked up and I said, you're the man. So, thank you. Guys, I saw stuff with my own two eyes. Like, it was happening. It was real. I saw the pain. I saw it all. My mom had no memory of it. What did God do? I don't know. I don't care. I call this thing God. You can call it whatever you'd like. But it's all powerful. And I went out in the room and I told my mom exactly what had happened. She wasn't brain damaged. As a matter of fact, her mental faculties came back 100%. And she began to learn to walk on these prosthetic legs. Now, guys, I'm going to tell you something. I was dog tired. But when I stood in that doorway and I heard those words come out of her mouth, there was a feeling that came over me that was like a blanket of everything's going to be okay. Like, God's got this. Because I can't do this stuff. And neither can anyone I know. Well, it was like Grand Central Station there. We had nurses and we had physical therapists and speech therapists and occupational therapists, and they were coming in and out every day and teaching my mom how to walk on these prosthetic legs, and my dad is still chasing Indians out in the yard. And I have a three-year-old and a one-year-old, and they're doing three-year-old and one-year-old things, and it's quite chaotic, as you can imagine. And again, I was dog tired. Chaos everywhere and peacefulness inside. I was doing AA. I had no idea. I had no idea. Because AA is an altruistic, spiritual program of action. Altruism. Yeah. I was doing things for the people that God put in my life, and I expected nothing in return. I wanted nothing. It was actually a privilege for me to be doing that. Number two, spirituality. I think we all know what that means. A complete reliance on God. You got to know I was relying on God. Like, people don't do that shit. That's pretty powerful. And action, yeah, I was putting forth action. I was up and I was doing stuff. People would come into the house, their friends, to visit, and they would say to me, like, oh my God, this is beautiful. Alcoholic that I am, what's beautiful? I'm looking around, it's a mess. We tend to look at outside things, don't we? And they would say, no, that's not what we mean. We mean the feeling in this house is beautiful. There's like a feeling of love. Yeah, that's God's love. That's God's unconditional love. And we feel it. And it is. It's beautiful. And it's comforting. And it's always there. And we're never alone. And I had that for a little while. My mom ended up, guys, living for 18 more years. She lived with us. She was a big part of my daughter's life. My dad ended up dying 5 years later from the Alzheimer's, but we took care of him till the end. I had to move them back to Florida in a year because we couldn't seem to sell our house or get jobs up here, so I guess God wasn't on board with us coming to Pennsylvania at that point in time. So we moved them back down to Florida with us, and guys, here it comes. Because you see, yeah, I had an awesome experience with God. But I don't know how to hang on to that, and I don't even know I'm supposed to. And here I come. Because as an alcoholic, man, my little thoughts, they start to regenerate. And these little ego thoughts are like cancer tumors. And pretty soon, I'm starting to take the credit. You see, I'd have friends come over, and they would say to me, oh, my God, what a good daughter you are. Yeah. Yeah, that's me. Let me tell you what happened when we were there. But then I had friends who were going, oh, yeah, we're taking the kids to Disney, you know, next weekend. They're so excited. And I'm like, I can't go to Disney. I'm stuck here taking care of these people. Wait a minute. I'm not going to have a life. I wonder how much longer this is going to go on. Now, I never became abusive or any sort of thing like that, but I'll tell you what, the peacefulness left. Oh, and the ugliness came. We see the beauty in what was going on when this first happened. Well, here I am. I'm back. Here comes Mother Extraordinaire. Okay, because I'm still home now. Now I'm taking care of the kids and my parents, and so I have to be the best at everything now. Oh, and I am. Don't you worry. So I'm going to become Girl Scout Leader Extraordinaire. Here I come. Here I come, folks. I bring home old shit, like, for the Girl Scout troop. Okay, like I brought home this trailer, old trailer. My husband came out. He said, what is that? I said, well, what it's going to be is a Christmas float. He said, what are you going to do? I said, well, what you're going to do. Have expectations much? You're going to paint it. And then he said these words to me. He said, wait a minute. I do not see other husbands out here doing these things for these Girl Scouts. And I said these words to him. I said, well, now, wait a minute. I didn't marry them, did I? And the reason I didn't marry them is because my expectations are a little bit higher for you. You're just that good. Oh, God love the man, he painted it. And I stayed up for 3 days and three nights, and I'm making these glittery little cardboard reindeer, and I'm slapping them on the sides, and oh, my God, here we come up little Jupiter Farms Road, Florida. In the Christmas parade, and guys, I thought I should be in the Macy's parade. And here I am, and I'm on the float, and I'm doing this for the girls. Bullshit. And I'm waving. Because I want all the other little girls to be in my troop, so my girls get more friends. And I want all you parents out there to know, just look at me. Yeah. Number one cookie sales right here. Yeah. Like, that's important. I'm nuts. Anyway. Yeah. I wanted my yard to be like a park, all right? We lived in this little equestrian community, had an acre and a quarter. I'm not a farmer, but I was going to pretend. I said to my husband, I would like an aviary. He said, what is that? I said, well, it houses birds. He said, why do we need an aviary? I said, well, let me tell you. Because, see, I want the yard to be like a park. I want the girls to, like, skip through the yard, like, I don't know, have a basket, wear lace, maybe. Skip through the yard, down to the birds. See the birds chirp. Under the sway of the palm. I'm going to plant rose bushes around it once you get it built. Over in that corner over there, I'd like to get a goat. Little goat. Maybe a few chickens. Rooster. Wouldn't you want to grow up like that? He goes, I don't think we need all that. I said, well, I guess you just don't want to
Be a good father.
Oh my God. He built me the aviary. And I went out to get the birds. I came home with 55. Because you see, I didn't want just one bird because it would look stupid. So I wanted to fill the aviary, so I got 55. So I'm feeding the birds. We're having little baby birds. I know how to make baby bird food if anyone needs a second job. See me after the meeting. I'm feeding the birds and I'm... Oh God, we got the goat. The goat was adorable. We bottle fed the goat, very 4-H. It's lovely. We had this little pygmy goat. I stenciled the fence with ivy. It lived in the little tyke's playhouse. Came to a terrible demise, but that's a different story. But anyway, I have the petting zoo. It's beautiful. Beautiful. Do you know what? A year later, my girls, my husband, they don't look at the birds. My girls don't even care about the birds. Do you know how noisy birds are? Do you know how dirty birds are? I don't want these birds. Nobody's even helping me with them. Here I am trying to do nice things for this family. You girls don't even go look at those birds. Go look at the birds, will you? We need to get rid of the birds. I'm done with this. Guys, the shine ever wear off for you? You know, you try to get stuff, make you happy. Yeah, for how long? It's all very temporary, isn't it? Yeah. Guys, I'm a maniac. I'm a maniac in sobriety. That's me. I'm an untreated alcoholic. I want that. I get that. It's gone. I want that. It's gone. Don't need that. Oh, but this. If I just got that car, you know, that one. Got that car. Driving it up. Jesus, it's a convertible. I have the roof down. I shouldn't have got this black interior in Florida. Friggin' hot. Do you think they'll take it back? Untreated alcoholism at its finest, restless, irritable, and discontent, and I don't even know why. Doctors seem to help us, though. I'd go to the doctor. She would say, well, what's wrong? I said, I don't know. You sound like you're depressed. I said, yes. Yes, I am. As a matter of fact, now that you say it, of course I'm depressed. You know what depression is? I think about myself. Now I go to a doctor and I convince the doctor that I think about myself way too much, so she gives me antidepressants. Oh, God, those things? Jesus, she puts me on them right now. I'm trying to exercise. I exercise like a maniac, by the way. And you don't do anything a little bit, do you? Anybody in here do anything a little bit? Because I don't. It's one way or the other, okay? I'm doing it or I'm not. Yeah, work. Work's another one. Yeah, oh, God, we're good at that stuff. Anyway, so I call her up and I'm like, God, I don't like the way this makes me feel. Like, I'm trying to exercise. I can't even, like, see the floor. It's, like, moving and shit. And she's like, just keep taking it. It will level out in your body. All right. So I keep taking this stuff. Yeah. Do you know what? It makes you fat. Now I'm fat. I called her up. I'm like, first of all, here's how I feel. Bleh. Like a toad, you know? Like the dog died. Bleh. I don't like this. And now I'm fat. I said to her, what kind of stuff you got for this fat to make it go away? Because I'm depressed because I'm fat, okay? Yeah. Anyway, fast forward because I got to start drinking. All right, so I do this for like 23 years, okay? So you get the picture. I need my phone. Because I don't know what time it is. Okay, so I start drinking. We moved up here. I told you I'm a fullback. And I told you, you know, at age 27, I put the plug in the jug because I didn't want my girls to ever, you know, see alcohol or mom drunk or anything like that. So do you know what? My youngest daughter, 18 years old at the time, you know what that bitch did? Not even kidding. She drank. Underage. The hell? So it's Christmas Eve. My theory's blown. I go out, I buy 4 bottles of champagne. I give 3 to the guests, and I drink the 4th. There you go. Oh, baby. You want to not talk about progression? Whoo, didn't know what hit me. It was great. The family thought it was hysterical. Here's mom, she's drunk, ha ha. I drink somewhat like normally every day. Right after that? No, I mean like not skip a day, like every day. But it was okay for a month. And my girls would come home and they would be like, Mom, are you drinking again? I'd be like, sure as hell I am. Making up for lost time. 23 years, you know. Bitch. Mom, but do you think you should be drinking that much? Well, you're drinking, aren't you? Yeah. Guys, I drank. After I made it a month with daily drinking, not blacking out. A month I'm blacking out and drinking to oblivion on a daily basis. And I drank for a total of 3 years and 10 months. Every day to oblivion. Didn't know what hit me. The depression, darkness. I hated my family. They hated me. Anybody have a little trouble with their personal relationships? No. I had to get to work. That's why I had to start chewing them Xanax. I didn't know about snorting that stuff. I didn't find that out until rehab. Guys, I got Mother of the Year award during my drinking. That youngest daughter of mine, she became suicidal. My other daughter came to me and said, Mom, Grace is going to commit suicide. She's so upset by your drinking and what you're doing, and we can't find you, and you disappear. I said, I'll fix that. I took all the guns out of the house, opened a bottle of wine. I wanted to stop, I think, but I couldn't. Because I don't know about you guys, but when you go to stop, Jesus, I'm angry at you. I hate life. This is boring. This sucks. And you give me any excuse and I'm going to get some booze. Even when I wake up and say to myself, this is stupid. What the hell are you doing? This has to stop. It's not stopping. Well, I'm not a happy little disco drunk. I actually get violently antisocial. I'm not very big, but I have a car and I have a gun. And I get these special abilities. I can tell if you're an asshole just by looking at you when I drink. Good times. And I can tell you're an asshole. I'm going to kill you. And I might as well kill your family too, because they produced you, therefore they must be assholes. That's alcohol logic, by the way. I ended up with a gun. I was going to kill someone and turn the gun on myself. My youngest daughter got the gun away from me, and both of my girls actually drove me kicking and screaming, literally, over to crisis at the hospital. And I passed out before I got there. I woke up on that gurney, and I'm laying in a hallway, and I ever wake up and not know where you are? And that's always a good time. And I looked up, and I see a piece of paper laying on my sheet, and I picked it up, and they wrote it nice and big. I didn't even need my reading glasses. And it said, homicidal and suicidal. And I said to myself, there's something wrong with you. You're sick. And I don't know what they do with people like me, but they need to do it. And I give up. I was willing to be committed for my life because I'm afraid of myself. For whatever reason, they did not put me in the psych ward. I went to a ghetto rehab center. My family put me there. They didn't like me. To be real, we knew nothing about this stuff. Because I didn't know about AA. I didn't know what you people did. I'm not an alcoholic. I don't know. So I go into this detox rehab, and it was such a blessing, man. I'm actually very glad I went there instead of something like these passages or whatever the hell that is. Yeah, or your horseback ride to sobriety or something. I don't know. But I went in there and I knew nothing. I knew nothing, but I knew I did not want to live the way that I was living. I did not want to be the person that I was. And I didn't know a way out of it because I can't stop, man. I can't stop. I got surrounded by a bunch of people, and it didn't matter what their age was, what their gender was, what their race was. When they opened their mouth in that detox and rehab, I felt like they were speaking my thoughts. And I said, this is screwed up. And I cried, and I was ashamed, and I was humiliated, and yeah, that gift of desperation, man. You know what a gift it is. And I hung on to that gift, and I listened. You know how it's the show? Yeah, group. The AA show's here. Group. NA. And I went in, and I sat, and I listened. Because I thought maybe these people knew something, and I needed help. And some people that came in, they made a lot of sense. Some people that came in, it wasn't, I don't know, man. We're not stupid, you know? I know that everybody in AA is very well-intentioned, and I love AA. I love all the people in AA. I don't care who they are. But I can remember in particular one big gentleman came in, and he sat down up in the front of the room, and I'm listening, you know? And he was an older guy, and he said, I'm so-and-so, alcoholic. I love when they say it that way. And he said, and I've been sober for 26 years. So take the cotton out of your ears and shove it up your ass. That's what I heard. Yes, I've never been in AA. No one's ever spoken to me about cotton. But I realized something right then and there. They were doing that for the heroin addicts. They use cotton. I found that out while I was in rehab. All inclusive. Anyway. But the next word out of his mouth was, look to your left and look to your right. I'm looking to my left, I'm looking to my right. It says, those people are going to go back out. AA has less than a 6% success rate. I'm going to say the F word right now because that's what I said. I looked to the left and I looked to the right and I said, it's going to be you, fucker. I'm not going back out. I don't want this life. And I desperately don't want it today either. He was miserable. And I said right then and there, I said, sir, you need a drink. Yes. 26 years of that? Thank God. So I decided that if that was what, you know, this whole sober thing was going to be about, no thank you, I'll drink till I die. Or I'll just kill myself. Something like that. Guys, my home group came in, and I immediately, I got scooped up right away by a big book study group, and that's where I've been ever since. When they came in and sat down, they talked about having had a spiritual awakening as a result of doing the steps and how cool life was for them right now. They were talking about going to concerts, not the Jason Aldean. They were talking about going to concerts and hanging out with their friends. So you could do that. Yeah, you can do that. They're talking about going and eating wings, at the bar. I'm like, really? Could do that? Yeah. They were talking about their family liked them. They were talking about, they do this sport in my home group. I don't know if you guys, disc golf? I thought it was an AA sport for a while. I don't know. It wasn't. They go out there, have a blast. I have a sleeve. My group has tattoo parties. I didn't have a tattoo. I have a sleeve. I'm not bald. Anyway. Yeah. They were so genuinely happy and content. Who doesn't want that? I want that. So when I got out of rehab, I asked my sponsor to meet me. I got a sponsor. And as soon as I walked out of the doors of rehab, he met up with me at Curry Donut, which I call Recovery Donut, since we all go there. And he sat down with me, and for 2.5 hours, he described what powerlessness was. And, oh, yeah, I'm powerless. I can't stay away from this stuff. Even when I want to. I changed my mind. And he talked about the restless, irritable, and discontent, you know, the unmanageability, because I really cannot manage sober. Because when I gave it up, I was pissed off at the world. And I hated myself. I hated life. It was too much energy. I got the whole step one thing. He described the illness, the mental obsession, and the physical allergy. And he described the spiritual sickness too, the spiritual malady. And I'm listening, and we're going through the book, and I got to tell you something. It tells us in the book that it's vital for the alcoholic to have a spiritual experience in order to overcome drinking. And at step two, when we sat there at Curry Donut, within that 2 hours, here's how he put step two to me. He said, "Do you believe that there's something out there that made all of this?" I didn't know that God had such a bad name. And I looked at him and I said, "Are you asking me if I believe in God?" And he said, "Well, yeah." I thought he was really beating around the bush with saying all those words, you know. I said, "Yeah, I believe in God." And then he said to me, "Do you believe that this God has enough power to save your ass from this illness?" I just told you a story about my mom, didn't I? Every one of those thoughts all at one time came crashing into my head. It was like waves bouncing into each other. Does God have enough power? Yeah, God has enough power. And that same feeling that came over me when I stood in the doorway, listening to my mom say, "Katie, what happened to me? Where are my legs?" That same feeling that God's got this. A blanket of just, I don't know, peace came over me. I was scared. I was still scared sitting there at Curry Donut. I knew there was a lot I had to do. But there's one thing about us, guys. We're not stupid. We're not lazy. We'll do things, and we'll do them to the best of our ability, man, when we buy into it. That was my spiritual experience. It happened right there at step two. We did step three, where I made that decision. And God, guys, when I say this, I mean that third step, yeah, it's my decision to turn my life over. And I say, "God, I offer myself to thee." Guys, when we offer ourselves, we're giving it away. Willingly, giving it away. Here I am. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Take me, God, and make me into exactly what you created me to be, please. Because you see, what I created was a selfish, self-centered bitch. And I'm motoring through this world and I'm running over people's lives. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Yeah, I'm in a prison, all right. It's a self-made prison, and I've locked the door, and I've thrown away the key, and I see no way out. And I hate it in that prison. You know, God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, so that I might better do your will, God. Because you see, I'm not depressed anymore. Because see, I used to get depressed when God didn't do my will. I don't do that anymore. Take away my difficulties so that victory over them may show others your love, your power, and your way of life. None of God's powers or love. Can be shown through me until I fully, fully make God everything. I made God everything that day. And as I said before, I desperately don't want to go back to that other way of life. It sucks. This way of life is beautiful. I've never been this peaceful or serene. I don't care if it was the 23 years I wasn't drinking. I don't care if it was when I was 5 years old in first grade. I've never been this peaceful and serene. This is sanity. I never experienced sanity before, I don't think. It's a beautiful feeling. I went through my steps in a month. That group took me under their wingman, and they had me out. They had me busy, and they taught me the ropes, and I'll be forever grateful to them. I love you guys, and I hope that everybody gets this. It's a beautiful life. Thank you.
Wonderful.